comes from the City of Urbana, presenting the local farmers market at the square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods, food, and original works of art, located in the southeast lot of Lincoln Square, downtown Urbana. Information at 344-2444.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. This is our number two of the show. And in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with a fellow who has had an experience that very, very few people have had. He is one of only 12 who have stood on the surface of the moon. Our guest is Harrison Schmidt. He's a geologist and was the first professional scientist to walk on the moon. This was in December of 1972. As part of the Apollo program, this was Apollo 17, do I have that right?
Correct.
Did I get the right number? Apollo 17. In 1965, he was selected by NASA as one of the first of its scientist astronauts. The one thing among the many things that distinguished him from the other astronauts was that he had not previously been a pilot. And one of the first things that he had to do, in fact, was go through flight training and was certified as a jet pilot. In 1965. He went on this mission in 1972, and he and the commander of the mission, Gene Cernan, spent more time on the surface. They were out of their spacecraft longer. They collected more lunar material than any previous lunar mission. Since that time, he's been involved in politics. He was a senator representing New Mexico. He was involved with NASA, managing the agency's energy program office. That was until 1975. After that, was in the Senate and continues to be involved in lecturing and consulting and writing about lunar exploration and space policy and also geology. And among other things, he is an adjunct professor of engineering at the University of Wisconsin. And he is here visiting in Champaign-Urbana. His visit sponsored by the Illinois State Geological Survey, where they're celebrating the centennial of the survey. And there will be a number of events over the coming months. He is here as a part of that. And for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, he'll be giving a talk, a public lecture, A Trip to the Moon and Beyond. That is tonight at 8 o'clock in the theater of Lincoln Hall on Wright Street on the campus. And anyone who is interested should feel welcome to stop by and hear what he has to say. Also here on the program, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the invitation very much.
Yeah. When the, in the early phases of the space program, the astronauts, they were people whose maybe their main qualification or one of the main qualifications was that they had flown high-performance jet aircraft. They were pilots and people like that were chosen. How is it that, though, in around 1965, something like that, the idea came to be that there would also be scientists, there would be astronauts who were scientists, people like you, who hadn't had that other kind of experience? How did that happen?
Well, first of all, I think it may do the pilots a disservice to say they were just test pilots of high-performance aircraft. They were all either masters or PhDs, in at least one case a PhD. They aeronautical engineers, they were quite accomplished people in their own right. And when we were in the process of training them, as I was deeply involved in, we mainly just had to make sure that the training was in the context of a mission rather than just trying to turn them into geologists. If they'd wanted to be geologists, they probably would have done that.
Yeah.
And certainly all of them would have been very capable of doing it. In the early 60s, when Kennedy and began the publicly began the Apollo program. Actually, essential things were happening well before that in the Eisenhower administration, particularly with respect to the development of the Saturn V launch vehicle, which without which Kennedy's announcement would not have been credible. But once Kennedy had put this on the national agenda, the idea of having scientists as part of the astronaut Corps was getting a fair amount of discussion, not only within NASA, but outside and in the National Academy. And in fact, a National Academy study of the time prior to I think it must have come out in 63, 64, recommended that the first person on the moon should be a hard rock geologist. And, of course, we all cheered. I was in graduate school at the time at Harvard. So the idea had been around. And as a consequence of a couple of summer studies, the National Academy persuaded NASA to jointly issue a call in November of 1965 for volunteers as astronauts. Now, scientists and engineering astronauts. I'm not sure whether that was fully agreed to within the astronaut office and the Johnson Space Center, but nevertheless, that call went out, and 1,400 of us raised our hands, volunteered, and after the selection process was done, and particularly the final physical, which was given to 16 of those 1,400, six of us survived the process. And I, fortunately for me, and fortunately I think for the program, was the only geologist.
Yeah. Well, what I've read about this, and you can tell me whether this is right or not, is that really nobody thought that you guys, you scientist astronauts, were going to go anyplace.
Well, I wouldn't say nobody. We certainly believed
well,
it.
Well, maybe you thought so. You thought so and wanted to. And who could blame you? Yeah, if you got a chance to go to the moon, of course you would go.
I think there was an initial fairly strong bias against having scientists in the program. The pilots are type A personalities. Certainly our boss, Deke Slayton, and the second boss, Al Shepard, were type A personalities and believed that they could learn to do anything that was necessary. That's fairly, I think, typical of groups of people, not just in this case, who are in that category of personality. And they can. The astronauts became excellent geologists without the broad background of experience that enables any professional to do a job. I would not try to be a test pilot in a high-performance aircraft, and would not at that time, or certainly not today, and would not have expected to be asked to do that. So having a diverse spectrum of capabilities, of experience, of professions in the astronaut program, like in many other areas, is, I think, very, very important. Mm-hmm. And it took a while, I think, to convince them that that was the case. And, in fact, even in the final analysis, it took the intervention of NASA headquarters to get me on the Apollo 17 crew.
Well, that was one of the questions I was interested in having you talk about, how it was that you actually managed to go. And from what I read, the commander of your mission was not all that happy. Maybe it was just he wasn't happy that another astronaut got bumped.
Well, you you bond very closely on these crews, however you may work in your private lives together. The professionalism of the crews is really quite remarkable, and Joe Engel had been training with Gene Cernan through the Apollo 14 backup crew cycle, and you can understand that having another person substituted on that crew would have been psychologically somewhat traumatic for a while, but it all gelled very quickly, and it became a non-issue.
Yeah. Well, no, I appreciate the point you made initially. I certainly would not want to minimize the qualifications, the background of the individuals who were astronauts in any way, shape, or form. And I guess I just wonder if too much is made of this this difference, particularly between you and all of the other guys, that they came out of a certain background, felt that they were in a sense part of a particular kind of corps or brotherhood, and that they saw you as being an outsider.
Well, there's no question that they felt that way for a while. But I think that all of us integrated ourselves into what needed to be done for the success of Apollo very well. Everybody worked that. I particularly worked it on the training cycles. I think it was a very wise decision that Deke Slayton insisted that we all go to pilot training, not only jet aircraft training, but eventually helicopter training. Mm-hmm. And it gave us all about at least some of the same foundation within the Corps in which we could talk, we could discuss things. That common experience, I think, was extremely important, as well as the training we got, the learning as a geologist, hard rock geologist, field geologist, learning how to put your faith in instrumentations, in controls, systems of jet aircraft, of helicopters, and also put your faith in your own ability to control situations. That was something that I had never experienced before, certainly not in the context of having to do that in a very rapid, time-critical fashion. So, I think that training for us was very good. Now, one thing that you could never give a pilot astronaut is 10, 15 years of experience in the field. There wasn't the time to do that. And so we brought them to the point of where they were very good they already were good observers because they were mostly test pilots, but very good explorationists in the spirit of, say, Lewis and Clark, who were not geologists either, although Lewis was turned out to be quite well trained in natural sciences. The astronauts, other than myself, really reached that point where they were very good exploration geologists in that sense, but without the experience that allows you to make very quick, instantaneous decisions on what may be important and what may not be important.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Harrison Schmidt, he's a geologist and was the first professional scientist to walk on the moon. That was in December 1972, was one of the crew of Apollo 17. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois, and we're pleased to have him here on the show. Questions welcome. We have a couple of people here ready to go, or one person ready to go. If you'd like to call in, 333-9455, here for Champaign-Urbana, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Champaign, line 2. Hello.
Dave Sutton here, brother of Robert Sutton, who in Flagstaff helped train you.
Oh, yeah. Well, Bob was a very good friend, and we worked together for a better part of a year. He was part of the group that I was heading up in what we call Lunar Field Geological Methods, I think.
Yes. Well, he... as I remember, was carted all over all the astronauts that went up were carted all over the world to where he didn't know the geology, and he had to sit on one side of the ridge and you on the other, and with an expert looking over my brother's shoulder. And to make matters more complicated, there was this 2-second delay or something between your communications, and he thought that was quite exciting.
Yeah, Bob was part of a group headed up by Gordon Swan most of the time. Dr. Swan was one of the USGS geologists that did a remarkable integration effort to get this training program really put together, the logistics of it, including the kinds of things that you describe. And what really began, I think, to make the pilots into true exploration geologists was that we put, with Sutton's help and Swan's help, put the training in the context of actual mission timelines. And we would go to a new site each time, so they were learning the geology reinforced by the context of the mission in which it was being learned. So that turned out to be a very, very effective way of training the pilots and getting them up to speed for exploration. And Bob Sutton was an extraordinarily important part of that.
Well, it's nice to chat with you. I can attest to your being a quick learner because, as I remember, we arm wrestled once. I beat you the first time when I knew a trick and you turned it right against me.
Well, that's the way it goes. Nothing like experience.
A question I had was why the cameras, does it make them too heavy to have... the cameras you would use on the moon, for instance, have a gyroscope, a laser gyroscope, built in and ranging from the lens so that whenever a picture is taken, the angle of the camera and the distance from the lens and, all that stuff is digitized along with the camera. Because I remember my brother saying it after, I think it was Apollo 12, sitting in a motel room in Houston going over 1,500 photographs, some of them from the moon and some of them from the lab, showing all of the rocks in different angles, trying to figure out what had been taken, what pictures had the rocks in place before they were picked up. And that was a big problem because the main thing was to find out what tip of the rock had been subjected to the latest micrometeorites.
Yeah, there'll always be some of that process of sorting, but there's no question that the next explorationists on the moon and on Mars should have, and I think will have, a much more sophisticated imaging and positioning system than we had. But to the credit of Gene Shoemaker, who headed up our group there in Flagstaff, Bob Sutton, Gordon Swan, and others, they tried to get a system based on the then available technology like that onto the Apollo missions. And indeed, a contract was let to try to build that system. They called it the surveying staff, but it included an imaging system, stereo imaging system. And unfortunately, the company that got the contract couldn't perform. And if it had been given to a larger business in those days, probably Kodak would have been appropriate. I think we would have had something like that for Apollo. But it was given to a much smaller firm on a small business set-aside, and it just didn't happen. I'm a great fan of small business. I don't want anybody. But in this particular case, the breadth of technology required for that system was just beyond the capability of that one company.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks.
Thanks for calling.
Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Astronauts go through extensive training, obviously. But is there any way to prepare someone for what it feels like when you're sitting on top of that rocket and it goes up?
No, not really. You sort of have to do it. You can get to a certain point in the simulators so that you're familiar with all the instrumentation, you're familiar with the clues for both a normal launch and an abnormal launch and everything like that. But the sensation of the extremely heavy vibration, the very slow onset of G-forces mixed with that very heavy vibration on a Saturn V is something you just don't simulate. You prepare yourself for it as best you can and try to make sure that you're not overwhelmed so that you can't perform the other duties. And that's what the training does. The training gets you in a position where you have confidence not only in yourself but also in the thousands of people who are supporting you.
Yeah. I can imagine that it would be frightening, exhilarating, both of those things.
Not
what
frightening.
That's
the training really takes you. If you were going to be frightened by these kinds of situations, you wouldn't have ever gotten involved. And pilot training, I think, has a lot to do with making you realize that you can't be frightened. You've got to work your way through situations if they come up. But exhilarating, yes. You anticipate something for a long time, and you find out it's far more than you ever anticipated. That certainly is part of it. It's an exciting thing to do, to sit on a rocket that weighs 6.2 million pounds, fully fueled, but has a thrust of five engines beneath you, totaling about 7.5 million pounds. The Saturn V is still the largest, most capable rocket ever used to put human beings in space, and may stay that way for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. Does it feel something like you're there, you're strapped in, you're in a big chair? Does it feel like there's a big pair of hands pushing you down into the chair?
You're actually in a couch. You're taking the G-forces transverse, as we say, that is through your chest.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the hands sort of very gradually increase pressure pushing you down. That in 2 minutes and 45 seconds on the Saturn V at the first stage, we reached 4 G's. That was our maximum acceleration. And there, if you try to raise your arm off your chest, let's say you've got it resting on your chest, to reach a switch or something, you're lifting 4 times the weight that you normally would lift. And you notice that very much so. At that point, though, at 2 minutes and 45 seconds, the first stage is shut off. It's basically used all its fuel. There's a staging event where it's dropped off. And then the second stage, the S2 stage, ignites. And that is at about 1G, 1.5G at that point, right off the bat. So you go from 4Gs to actually a negative 1.5Gs as the stack unloads. You actually get an unloading effect. And then a plus 1.5Gs. As the second stage ignites, and that takes place in just slightly over a second. And that gets your attention.
Yeah, I'll bet.
But from then on, it's a very smooth ride. The next two stages were hydrogen-oxygen systems. It's very smooth-burning systems, whereas the first stage was oxygen-kerosene, rougher burning, but a very efficient way to get the whole thing started.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with someone else. Here's a caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, two questions. Did you you were talking about preparation a little bit ago, and as I understand it, the major idea about the creation of the moon is that it broke off from the Earth right now. And I was wondering did you prepare in any way to check that idea of the moon's creation or not?
Well, one of the broad scientific questions of the time was the origin of the moon, and I would submit it's still a broad scientific question. I'm not one of those that accepts the so-called giant impact hypothesis categorically. But nevertheless, there were at that time, prior to getting any samples back from the moon, there were a number of hypotheses about the origin of the moon. And we were not specifically trying to test any one of those, but the exploration plan was set up so that we would get as broad a spectrum of information, samples to provide geochemical information, photographs to provide structural information about the surface, even seismic information about the subsurface. We have information down below 500 kilometers as a result of the seismic net that was deployed during Apollo. So we were trying to get as much information we could in order to sort through those various hypotheses. And in fact, essentially all of them were discarded, which is the great thing about science. And everybody went back to the drawing board and started to look at the geochemical data and to do a great deal of computer modeling. And out of that came this idea, that hypothesis, that the Earth in its very early years, within the first 30 million years actually, was subjected to the impact of a giant asteroid, about Mars size, maybe slightly smaller. From the debris that was ejected into Earth orbit by that impact, the moon then coalesced. I think it's a great computer modeling story, and more than likely giant impacts have taken place elsewhere in the solar system. My problem is that the data from the interior of the moon that we have obtained from the pyroclastic glasses, which are the volcanic or materials that have erupted from the deep interior of the moon, I don't think can support that. They show a very primitive interior of the moon, and that signature would not be there if it had formed by a giant impact.
That's a wonderful story, though.
I mean, it's great. The teams that have put together these computer models have just done a fantastic job, and it certainly is applicable, I think, to situations elsewhere in the solar system. For example, Mercury. Mercury has a very, very large core compared to its mantle, the remainder of the planet, and it's awfully hard to explain that in total solar system dynamics and chemistry without a giant impact having knocked off a major portion of the surface materials of Mars, of Mercury.
I had one other question, and I'll hang up. And that is, I always wondered, as a kid, I was thinking that if I had my druthers and I was directing the whole space moon exploration thing, I would immediately try to set up a moon base on the dark side, but I never hear about that. And it occurred to me that maybe it's because of the how scary that would be to our enemies. I don't know. But maybe
no.
Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, no. The far side of the moon, which by the way isn't always the dark side of the moon. The far side of the moon is a very exciting location for a number of scientific reasons. First of all, there's an extremely large basin on the far side. It's about 2,500 kilometers in diameter. It's about 12 kilometers deep. It's called the South Pole Aitken Basin, and it may be a place where one could get samples of the lunar mantle as a result of that huge impact. And also understanding these huge impacts, which occurred very early in the history of the moon, would enable us to understand what their effect was when they occurred on Earth, which they almost certainly were at the same time. Also, the far side of the moon is protected from radio emissions from the Earth. And during the darkness, the far side, it would be protected from radio emissions from the sun, and therefore is of great interest to radio astronomers. They would like very much to have that extremely low noise environment around them if they set up a radio telescope on the far side of the moon. So it has been discussed, and indeed I proposed that Apollo 17 land on the far side of the moon before the site was finally selected as the Valley of Taurus Littrow. And a little ad hoc volunteer team that worked nights around the Johnson Space, then Manned Spacecraft Center, worked out how you would do that, where you would place the communication satellites, how you would navigate to the crater Tsiolkovsky, which is a large basin on the far side of the moon. And so we had it pretty well worked out. But Chris Kraft, who was the director of NASA at the time, of the Johnson Space Center, Manned Spacecraft Center, at the time, really caught me in the hall one day and said, "Jack, let's forget about that far side landing." The agency, in a very, what you might call liberal endeavor, was getting quite conservative. And it was the last mission. Everybody knew it was the last mission. And so let's go somewhere else. And Taurus Littrow turned out to be a fantastic geological location anyway. So anywhere you went on the moon, and even today, anywhere you go on the moon, it's going to be exciting and very productive scientifically.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Harrison Schmidt, he's a geologist and was the first professional scientist to walk on the moon. That was Apollo 17. He was part of that crew. This was December 1972. He is one of only 12 people to have walked on the moon. Also then after that, he continued to be involved in NASA. He worked in the agency's energy program office. He then entered politics. This was in 1977. He became a United States Senator representing New Mexico, served a single six-year term. After that, continued to do lecturing, consulting, writing on lunar exploration and space policy. He's here visiting the campus as part of the celebrations for the centennial of the Illinois State Geological Survey. And if you're interested in hearing more from him, he'll be giving a public talk, A Trip to the Moon and Beyond, tonight at 8 o'clock in the Theater of Lincoln Hall on the U of I campus. That's on Wright Street. So anyone should feel welcome to attend. And questions here, welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I know, I'm sure, after countless times over the years, people have said to you, "So, what's it like?" Well, I'm afraid I have to. How do you go about describing the experience of walking on the moon?
Well, you'll never be able to describe it adequately. It's something like many things in life you have to do yourself. Being there is the essential human ingredient. But physically, it's like, because of the 1/6 gravity, it's like walking on a giant trampoline. You're just as strong as you are here on Earth, but you don't weigh as much. Your mass is the same, and so you have to watch what you do with respect to movement and your center of gravity and things like that. But you can move very differently, and if you want to think about walking on a giant trampoline, that's a good one. And if you want to run very fast, you can use a cross-country skiing technique, gliding above the surface, just above the surface instead of on it, and that works very well. You can probably go 15 kilometers an hour very easily once you get used to handling yourself, and if you had a couple stabilizing poles, that would work very well. The visual experience is something that normally you would not ever have here on Earth. A little bit like being in very high mountain country after a new snow in terms of the optics characteristics of the lunar surface. It has a very high backscatter. Even though it's gray, it still gives you a very bright backscatter. That's why the moon looks as bright as it does to us. And that's why also why it looks just as bright at the edges as it does in the middle, is it has this very high backscatter at what's called zero phase, that is with the sun directly behind you. The mountains that were on either side of this in this valley were very high. They were actually, the valley's deeper than the Grand Canyon of the Colorado. The mountains are 7,000 feet high on either side, brilliantly illuminated. but all placed against a blacker than black sky. There, because there's no atmosphere on the moon, your sky is black. You can't see the stars because of your eyes, although a remarkable optical system is not that remarkable that it can have the dynamic range to see both the bright, brilliantly illuminated slope and the stars. But you can see the Earth. The Earth is very clear and very beautiful, hanging over one of the mountains, always in the same part of the sky, depending on where you are on the moon, but it doesn't move around as we're used to seeing the moon do. That's because the moon's face is always oriented towards the Earth, the same face, the so-called near side of the moon. So it's a remarkable visual experience, one which, again, hopefully more and more people will have a chance to see on their own.
Well, when you got out and got a little bit away from the craft and had a chance to walk around and look around, and did you in some way say to yourself, "Holy cow, I'm on the moon"?
Well, mentally, we said, I never said that out loud.
I mean, yeah, sort of to yourself. I mean,
but you're trying to get as much done as you possibly can. Time is relentless, as my former colleague Dick Gordon used to say, and it is. Time just keeps going, and physics doesn't change and allow you to stay longer than you wanted to. It really was. Being there was the essential ingredient, as I said. And every time you moved another 10 meters or so, you had a new experience. There was something you didn't expect to see. Mm-hmm. And that's what exploration is all about. I'm sure Lewis and Clark had the same feeling as they moved up the Missouri River and into the northwest part of the United States at that time. Yeah, it was Louisiana Territory. Hmm. But that's why exploration is so exciting. And some of us get it in our blood, and we would like to keep doing it all our lives.
I have some callers here. I promise I will get to them. Just let me ask you one other thing. You were there to collect material, and you knew that you could only bring back so much. How did you decide when you were standing there and you were looking around that everything was there? How did you decide what it was you wanted to pick up, what it was you wanted to look at, and what it was you wanted to bring back?
Well, I never worried about collecting a sample. We just collected everything that seemed to be appropriate at that point and within the time constraints that we had for a particular station that we had planned to go to. We had a lot of flexibility. We tried to plan everything out on what might be of interest. And it turns out that was a pretty good plan, but still we had flexibility to do whatever seemed to be the best thing for us to do. That's what exploration is all about. You want to follow clues as far as you can within the time available, made decisions. I made decisions on what we should sample. Pretty routinely and as continuously as I could to get as broad a spectrum of the appropriate materials based on my geological experience, what would be pertinent to the particular problem that we had identified. For example, when we found what became known as the orange soil, turned out to be orange pyroclastic glass, volcanic glass deposit that was in the edge of a crater. We were running behind our timeline at the point, and we had sort of allocated, we could only allocate about a half an hour to work at that particular point. We had planned to be there and that we found this soil, didn't know that we would. And so I immediately, we didn't have to consult with Houston or anything, went into a sampling program. We would first of all to dig a trench across this little deposit so that we could get more idea of what its three-dimensional characteristics were, and then to sample sequentially various parts of it so that I got a spectrum of samples through the deposit as well as in what we call the wall rock or the wall soil on either side of it. So that it's a fairly logical thing you get into when you try to sample a deposit of that kind. And within a half an hour, we had it sampled, I described. We had a core tube put down through it as far as we could, 70-centimeter core tube. And it was driven down into it and recovered. So it was probably the most productive half hour anyone's ever had on the moon, I think. But it was because we knew what we had to do in order to get the information necessary to study that deposit later back here on Earth.
Okay. Well, let's talk with some other folks. We have a caller here in Lafayette, Indiana. Line 4. Hello.
Oh, I was wondering, it seems like Apollo has collected a large amount of rock, and almost all of that has been kept locked up in a safe. I know there's been some work done, but as far as I have been able to figure, not a whole lot, and they're very, very hard to get access to that material. So what I was wondering is how effectively you think this material has been utilized once it was recovered.
Well, on the one hand, I would say it's been very effectively utilized. It is still being distributed today. You, of course, have to make a proposal that goes through a committee that scientists that decide the merits of the proposal and what the allocation of samples should be. But that's going on today, not quite at the level as it was during the actual Apollo missions. But there, all the samples have been looked at. Many of them have been portions of them have been studied in great detail. There's a tremendously thick pile of literature of publications on these rocks and on this material. It's a very, very active of intellectual research, area of intellectual research today. Now, having said that, I don't think I would if I was emperor of this whole thing, I would allocate much larger chunks of rock and portions of soil to investigators. I think we're losing the broad context of individual investigations by not having these larger rocks studied in great detail rather than just looking at a small piece of them knocked off the corner. So to some degree, I agree with the thrust of your question. That we ought to be doing more and they ought to allocate larger portions of the samples. But these samples have been very extensively studied. And if you were working in the field, you would be, I think, quite amazed at how much information we have gained from those samples over the last 30 years.
Okay, I think I was kind of concerned about the large quantity that, you know, seems to be held in reserve. And
well, it's held in, there is a quantity held in reserve. And I have to take some responsibility for that. When I was in the Senate, I was very much worried about having all the samples in one place, namely in Houston, that where hurricanes, as we've seen recently, have a chance to go through. And NASA agreed that they would split up the collection, and a portion of it has, for a long time, was in San Antonio at the air base there, Brooks Air Base. And now has been moved out actually to White Sands, New Mexico, in a secure facility. But they're portions of rocks, not the whole rocks. The sample collection has been very well studied and characterized. And I just hope that now in this new initiative to go back to the moon, that NASA will open it up a little bit and get a broader, particularly in terms of size, but get a broader investigation program going.
Okay, I think you've answered my question.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Bloomington, Indiana, line number 2. Hello.
Hi. You were talking about the origin of the moon. Many scientists say that origin, the origin of the moon, is critical to making Earth friendly to life. You said that the moon was supposedly created when another planet collided with the Earth. But scientists say that collision had to be very precise. It had to be a glancing collision. And it had to cause the Earth to lose most of its atmosphere. If it had not been for that collision, Earth would have an atmosphere heavier than, higher pressure than the atmosphere of Venus. Our lungs wouldn't operate well at that high pressure. Would you comment on that? And then I have another question for you.
Well, you sort of point out one of the intellectual problems, philosophical problems with the giant impact hypothesis. And that it does take a very precise hit in order for this all to end up the way it did. And almost certainly whatever primitive atmosphere was around the Earth, probably hydrogen, methane, probably some CO2 in it, maybe some nitrogen at the time, that would have probably been dissipated. But the Earth was degassing. You had volcanic activity going on later, so a new atmosphere would be created from the materials that were not affected, fully affected by the so-called giant impact. Probably the most important thing that the moon has contributed to the development of and stability for the evolution of life on the planet is its mere presence. It gives a dynamic stability to the Earth-Moon system that, for example, Mars doesn't have. Mars goes through all sorts of oscillations over long periods of time, but still times that would be critical in terms of being a relatively unstable environment for broad-scale development of life. So the Moon does contribute in that way. It creates a dynamic two-planet system, if you will, that is much more stable than it would have been without the Moon.
Yeah, that was going to be my second question. The gravitational resonance of the Earth-Moon system stabilizes our orbit, doesn't it?
Yes, and stabilizes our inclination.
Okay.
You don't get this as much oscillation or of the axis of the Earth as you see, for example, for Mars.
So the axis of the Earth doesn't wobble.
Doesn't wobble, right?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Precession is the word I was searching for.
Okay.
Well, let's go to another caller. This is Champaign County, and it's line number one. Hello.
Drawing from what you're saying just there, we wouldn't be able to be here to observe the accurate strike of the asteroid producing the Moon if. So we wouldn't know it. I mean, I think the other caller was saying it's so unlikely that this would have happened just right. Well, we're here partially because it happened just right.
Yeah, and it certainly is a viable hypothesis. And the only reason I say don't jump to conclusions yet is because the detail of that hypothesis hasn't yet found a way to explain the presence, for example, in the orange pyroclastic glass that I described a little bit earlier, the presence of what we call primordial geochemical signatures, that is material that is related to the earliest history of the Earth that would have been obscured and eliminated by the kind of process required for a giant impact. It's just that the giant impact hypothesis is not yet able to explain where that material, how that material could be present in the deep interior of the Moon. And so all I'm asking is that people who have bought giant impact lock, stock, and barrel step back a little bit and say to themselves, it's just a hypothesis, and it still needs to explain all the geological information that we have gotten from the Moon.
Well, there were still a lot of asteroids impinging on both the Moon and the Earth, and it's astonishing how much, you know better than I, how much material is from the other body and vice versa, right?
Well, no question. And in fact, we know of at least one very large impact on the Moon that was recorded so that we can see it. There probably, I think that you can find evidence of four or five or six of these very large impacts, one of which, the so-called Procolarum Basin Formation event, created a basin that's 3,200 kilometers in diameter. Those are continental-scale events and may well have triggered the formation of the first continents here on Earth. That's a longer story to get into. But clearly, if it was happening on the Moon, it was happening in spades on Earth because of its larger cross-section.
Well, I would love to just talk about this, but I feel pressured to talk about the way defense policy, or so-called defense policy, military policy, and space policy have impinged upon each other, too, in sort of colliding sort of ways, maybe metaphorically. You were probably in the Senate when the shuttle was upsized. There are people that have said, Jack Mano, who wrote a book called Arming the Heavens, has the idea that the shuttle was upsized because of military impulses, which actually the military then didn't like the shuttle very much afterwards, so they sort of abandoned it. But it was sort of this milieu of defense industry, defense policy, and that still seems to be happening today. There are some people that suggest that the mission to the Moon to Mars justifies a higher lift vehicle than we have now, which would be useful for the kind of platform in the heaven kind of space policy, defense policy, military policy that is in the document called Vision 2020 that the Air Force produced some time ago. So, I really wish that I didn't have to ask the question, but we do live in a world where these are, I think, important issues, and I just wanted to get at least some kind of response from you on that, and then maybe other people who are interested can go to just Google Jack Mano. I believe the book is out of print, but I think there's still libraries to have a copy of this.
Well, you know, by law, by the Space Act of 1958, NASA is obligated to work with the Department of Defense and other agencies as it relates to our national security. But it worked largely independently. I think you were correct in the that the Air Force did have some influence on the design characteristics of the shuttle. I don't think that there's any question about that. That's been pretty well documented. But I think there were much bigger questions of whether the shuttle was a good idea than whether the it was going to be used or not used by the Air Force. That's a separate subject. But NASA, like all of us, are obligated to be concerned about our national security. And the technologies developed by NASA, almost essentially entirely in the public domain, are certainly available to assist and have assisted in our national security efforts. I can truly say that I flew and worked as an astronaut without knowing anything that was classified. I had top secret clearances, but we just didn't need it. We didn't use defense-related stuff. My colleagues were all defense, Air Force, Navy, or Marine trained, but most of them were. But we were not working in a military program. There's just no question about that. I think just before we left for the moon, we were given one little bit of classified information that would be only pertinent if we had ended up in an alternate mission in Earth orbit that for some reason we weren't able to launch out of Earth orbit, and so we spent a couple weeks in Earth orbit. There was one little piece of information, I can't remember what it was, I just remember we were given it, that related to that. But overall, NASA has been a civilian agency, and the Air Force and other departments of the Department of Defense have been military agencies, and there has been cross-feeding between them in terms of personnel and ideas and technologies. But I think if you're worried about NASA being a captive of our defense policy, I wouldn't. But I also would worry very much if NASA weren't cooperating and providing what they can for our national security, which is under tremendous threat, both directly today and also indirectly when we start to look at the future.
Do you think that it was a mistake for us to put so much of our resources into working in near-Earth space as opposed to going deeper for now all these years since the Apollo program ended?
Well, it's a water under the bridge now. I think in an alternate universe, you would not have abandoned the Apollo technology. And there are a whole bunch of good reasons of why it was abandoned. In fact, it began to be abandoned in 1969 before Neil Armstrong ever landed on the moon. The production lines of the Saturn V were shut down and so forth. I think that was an error, policy error made on the part of the Congress and the Nixon administration and on the part of the then NASA, who wanted to go build something different than the Apollo. They're engineers, for crying out loud, and you can understand that. But still, it takes policy guidance, and I think the policy guidance was flawed at that time, and it's been a distraction. If let me just give you one example of what it meant not to have a Saturn V capability sustained, and that is that if one were to identify an object large enough to cause serious impact problems on the Earth, an asteroid or cometary object, without the Saturn V technology, we do not have the ability to react to that. For one brief shining period, pardon the expression, we did have the ability with a Saturn V rocket to do something about an object that might be headed towards the Earth. We can have that again with that capability, but we should not have abandoned it. Even though nothing like that happened, the point is that we now have the technological sophistication in human species and in the United States specifically to have had that kind of protection. Now, there are many other reasons why one would want to maintain that technology, improve it, create better and better systems, not only for maybe every 2 or 3 years for a visit to a lunar base, like a Little America kind of base in Antarctica, continue the science, but also because now we know and found out about 13 years after the fact that there are energy resources on the moon namely a light isotope of helium that is an ideal fuel for fusion power, that we would have probably begun to exploit much sooner than we're going to now had we maintained that base. We didn't know that at the time, but it just illustrates how when you give up a fantastic capability like the Apollo systems, you're going to lose in the long run. They're just opportunities that you can never take advantage of.
Well, we now have people who are presenting designs for vehicles to go again, and the president has said he would like to see the United States go back to the moon, have a presence there, go on to Mars. Do you expect that to happen? Will there be human beings on the moon again and then on Mars, and when?
I have no doubt there will be human beings on the moon and on Mars. I don't know when. I don't know what flag they will take there. But at least now the president has put the moon in play for the world as well as for the United States, and I think that's very important, not only because of its energy resources, but also because of the science and the potential for human settlement that exists. Humans can live on the moon independent of the Earth, and they can live on Mars independent of the Earth. Now, on the energy side of things, I have a book coming out in November that will sort of a how-to for the private sector as well as the public sector to take advantage of those energy resources. But it is something that is just uncertain in terms of when the investors and or the taxpayer are going to be willing to move forward in that area and what, again, what flag they will move forward under.
Well, we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry we have some people we can't take because we've come to the end of the time. Our guest, Harrison Schmitt, he's a geologist, the first professional scientist to walk on the moon. That was in December 1972, Apollo 17. Continues to be a very strong advocate for space exploration. And if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you can hear more from him. He'll be giving a talk, A Trip to the Moon and Beyond, tonight at 8 o'clock in the Theater of Lincoln Hall on the U of I campus. He's here as part of the celebration of the centennial of the Illinois State Geological Survey. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank your audience very much for their participation.
Today's broadcast made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department offers box lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. The program also made possible by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, providing income to third world artisans by marketing their handicrafts and telling their stories in North America. That's it for us. We want you to stay tuned, though. Next up is the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, our guest will be Narendra Jadhav. He is the author of Untouchables, My Family's Triumphant Journey Out of the Caste System in Modern India. He will join us following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look at prices now on the Chicago Board of Trade. December wheat, 344 and a quarter, down 3 and a quarter. March, 358, down 3 and a half. December corn, 204 and a quarter, down 1 and a half. March, 217, down 1 and a quarter. May corn, 224 and a half.